You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
But up next on The Wire, we have a piece by Rachel. So, do you want to give us a bit of a background onto your little talk?
Yeah, sure. So, it's often said that the debate around euthanasia is not black and white, but rather grey. Last week, a group of 21 mental health experts signed an open letter to MPs detailing the facts and evidence regarding assisted dying and suicide rates. I usually think about the 1973 sci-fi film Soylent Green when talking about euthanasia. In an overpopulated post-apocalyptic world where there's no longer enough resources to sustain people, if you'd like to die, you can just go to a hospital, they ask your favorite music, and they peacefully allow you to die. And the essential question is there a right to die? Or maybe even sometimes a duty? I talked to Dion Howard, who is a registered nurse and specialist youth mental health worker. We discussed the experience of professionals who see these issues firsthand. Please be advised that this interview might contain some sensitive material. I started by asking him to explain what the open letter says.
So the letter is signed by 20 people who are sort of leading academics or practitioners in medicine and mental health and research. And really what it's saying is that the idea that there can be no risk around our current suicide rates because of the introduction of euthanasia is not founded on any solid evidence. So really there's a whole lot of uncertainty as to what might be the impact of euthanasia, new euthanasia legislation, if it's introduced, what might be the impact on suicide rates.
And so what kinds of people have signed the letter?
So, I've signed the letter, but I'm a registered nurse working at adolescent mental health. So I do therapy with people who are chronically suicidal or deliberately self-harming. That's my area of specialty. But most of the other people, for instance, Kirsty Loudon, who works in the area of suicide prevention, professors of CBT at Otago University, just giving you a sample of some of the people, Dr. Richard Linscott, who's a senior lecturer in psychology at Otago, John Adams is a psychiatrist. So a lot of psychiatrists in there, so people with a strong hand in mental health, and a couple of people working in elderly medicine as well.
So what do you think attracts people in these professions to the cause?
Do you mean to this particular cause, like to sign this
letter? Yeah. So why are these academics and psychiatrists, why are these types of people interested in?
Why are they interested? I guess they are interested in public policy being shaped by evidence, and they have a concern that there's been a real lack of evidence. The efforts going towards legalising euthanasia have in some part been advanced by the idea that it's safe. And what's attracted these people is that they would say, and the letter says, that there is little to no evidence to kind of confirm that it would be safe. In fact, there's very few studies into the area. It is such a new emerging field internationally. There's been really one study, and one of those studies is frequently cited by David Seymour, for instance, and proponents as kind of outlined that it is evidence of its safety, when in fact the study, which is an Oregon study from 2015, really just says that there's been no decrease in suicides, which is interesting because one of the claims has been that the introduction of euthanasia will lead to a decrease in suicides. And that study has been cited widely, and the feeling of the letter writers is that it's been misrepresented as well.
Okay, so could you elaborate on what's meant by the direct or indirect causal relationship between assisted dying and assisted suicides? How are they connected? Each other,
suicide?
So assisted dying and assisted suicides, how do they relate?
How do they relate to each other? Well, I mean, I guess both of them involve an act of will to decide to end one's life. Frequently, and I think the idea has been sort of proposed that they have nothing to do with suicide. And I would suppose in many senses that's true. You know, the Act doesn't propose for people to commit suicide for, or for no good reason, or to make a willful act, whether with the assistance of someone else or not, to end their life. So in many ways, suicide and assisted suicide and euthanasia are not the same, but in some ways they are also the same. And the question is, we don't really understand in which way that they are the same. And my interest really began when I started talking to young people who started to employ the justifications around end of life with regards to their own sense of hopelessness and wanting to end their own lives. And so they were utilising the arguments of bodily autonomy, and unbearable suffering. And I found that really interesting. Of course, the proposed legislation doesn't qualify them to do that. But what's important to understand is whether or not it would have an unintended impact. And really, there's no strong evidence to say that it wouldn't have an unintended impact. So we are really urging our MPs to consider this and consider whether or not should we be more certain about the impact on our suicide rates before we pass this legislation.
I think that's very true, like the national sentiment that there's a right to die, or maybe even sometimes a duty, that will actually affect other people. But can we equate young people dying because they feel they have no autonomy and no choice? Is it the same as people on their sickbed choosing to die?
Well, I guess that's a good question and it needs to be answered. And that's really what the letter is about. Can we equate it? And I would say in my practice, I began to see some alarming situations where people were equating it. Now, it's not reasonable to equate it. It's not sensible to equate it. But that doesn't actually matter. What matters is, will it be equated and will that change the impact? And what we do know, for instance, in the Netherlands, that there has been a slow and steady increase in suicides, while the surrounding countries have had quite a rapid decline in suicide. And we don't know why that is, but what we can't do is discount or dismiss a euthanasia-enabling environment as to be an active factor in that process. Yeah, so it's not really even so much to do with the ethics of it, but rather to do with the impact and the potential unintended consequences.
There's a lot of discussion about, like, David Seymour's whole thing is, like, you know, the right to choose, the right to be free.
Sure.
And do you think a personal right to choose sometimes actively harms or doesn't meet the needs for society as a whole? Do you think that's the kind of ethos of the letter?
I don't think that's the ethos of the letter. I think that, That's a question about personal morality. I think the ethos of the letter is, can we be certain that this will be safe and not have an impact? And really they're advancing the idea that there is very little certainty. And in fact, the legislation has been advanced with lots of assurance that there is certainty, and there is actually no certainty. There is a lack of evidence to say that it is safe. So the question around whether the right to choose can have harm society or not, I guess we get to choose that as a democratic and parliamentary process. We get to kind of make that decision. But in order to make a decision, we should have all the facts on the table. And one of those facts perhaps should be some better understanding and research as to whether or not this would have an effect. And we do have the potential for instance, in Canada, who have just enacted very similar legislation to what we're proposing, to actually wait and see if it does have an impact. But what we tend to have is David Seymour and proponents dismissing the concerns, and I think they've done a reasonably successful job. But David Seymour, he's an advocate, not a researcher, and they've successfully dismissed concerns. And we're really just saying, shouldn't we be certain? Are we certain? No. Should we be certain? Yes, we should.
So could you speak a little on the precautionary principle that's mentioned in the letter?
Sure. Well, I guess in lay people's terms, the precautionary principle is simply that if there is doubt that something may trigger or lead to a greater harm, we should not proceed or proceed with caution. And, you know, I mean, it's a principle that we would sort of reflexively operate in every day in our lives. You know, if we perceive a danger, we will pause, scan the environment, gather evidence, is it safe to go on? And simply in this situation, we need to, utilising that precautionary principle, we would say we need to stop, scan the environment, what's happening in Canada, how do we understand what's happened in the Netherlands, do we have actual evidence, not advocacy, but rather, you know, some robust evidence, and then proceed if it's safe.
So do you think it matters that our demographic for suicide is predominantly, you know, young, usually teenage, Māori, like males, like those are the demographics. Do you think it matters that that's different to the European and Canadian studies?
Well, it does. I mean, we can't necessarily draw. I mean, frequently we've been advised to draw from the other countries as evidence that it's safe, but we have a unique environment. So really there perhaps should also be, you know, some research in our context, although for obvious reasons, a very difficult thing to research. So, you know, one level of research is to look at other examples, and we need to do that. And what would be, how would we compare and contrast those examples to our context? So, you know, and in New Zealand, we're in a particular situation where the death by suicide rate is particularly high around young Māori. And what does that mean? You know, and the people that are advancing the legislation are not young Māori. You know, they tend to be predominantly Pākehā and older and affluent people advocating for this change. So in some sense, we need to be very mindful of our context and consider who would be the most impacted by any unintended consequences of this legislation.
So where do you think the line needs to be drawn? Like, what changes will we have to make to the bill for your group to support euthanasia?
Well, I think everyone would have a different, every letter signer or signatory to the letter would have a different position
yeah,
on
course,
that.
Yeah.
My personal view is that the end-of-life choice bill is not safe until we've made those, until we have those assurances. Now, I speak as a clinician working with suicidal young people. You know, I don't think that the bill is safe until we have that evidence that it is safe, and then I think we go back to the drawing board.
So why do you think New Zealanders are so divided on the issue, and how do you think the referendum will go?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, you're speaking about the referendum as if it's a fait accompli, and certainly there is that sense, you know, as the third reading this week.
Right, that might not even happen.
Yeah, well, it may not, but, you know, I think one reason why we seem divided is the way, you know, I've not seen a piece of legislation that kind of promises or overstates the benefits so much. And I think partly that's to do with people have so little experience of dying, or other people dying, rather, I guess, to be more accurate. People are frightened of that process and the pain and discomfort, you know, but I think the proponents have made a very effective job of capturing the narrative around that. Yet the experts in the field, you know, palliative care experts, they certainly tell another story. So, yeah, I wonder if we're so divided because it sort of keys in with other sort of issues around freedom and political identity and this kind of right to not be told what to do, it seems to be. But I would suspect that if we had all the facts in front of us, we would not be so divided and we'd find it actually much more grey than we realise.
That's what I think. It's a really grey issue. Even I find it really complex, and I was really nervous to do this interview because I'm really on the fence.
Sure. Well, look, look, I started doing some work in this area, and you know, I made a submission to the Health Select Committee at the last round as well because of my experience.
Yeah.
And I made a submission to the Select Committee, and in that process, my own father died of cancer, and had kind of like around an 18-month a period of illness, I guess, as he was living the last part of his life. So I was very frightened that I, you know, would be very challenged in my point of view by that experience.
Yeah.
And we all sense that because actually that's something that happens to everyone as everyone dies. And we want to have a good death, and indeed, probably we would prefer, we don't want to see our loved ones suffering, and we want them to have a good death as well. And, you know, I think it is complex because we have a lot of those feelings that we don't necessarily want to sort of confront or face around that.
Yeah.
And I would have to say that in my father's death, and that's only one, you know, situation, and this debate has been very much coloured by people's individual stories, but we must remember that we're making public policy.
Yeah.
But I must say that my father's death was, how do I put it, like an incredible experience with the support and care of hospice. It was not an easy experience, but I don't think any good experience is easy. And, yeah, it was not what I expected it to be. Let's just kind of say that. So, you know, I think it's complex and people are divided because it's to do with something that we're all quite frightened of. And
yeah,
I don't
exactly,
think we're necessarily
yeah.
frightened of death, but of dying. And we're very sheltered from it in our society now.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was reporter Rachel Simpson speaking to Dion Howard about the relationship between suicide and future end-of-life bills.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.